Bixshiri Menswear in Clarendon Street in Dublin, and Best Cafe Tea Shop is the Brown Hound in Drogheda. Congratulations to all. And finally, The Independent runs a story on gaffes made by Australian politicians on the stomp during the election campaign, including this malapropism by Tony Abbott. No one can be the suppository of all wisdom.
Thanks very much indeed, Deirdre Purcell. That's all for now. Next news here at 10.
RTE Radio 1.
Discover the power of the One Ring through Howard Shore's music of The Lord of the Rings. Beneath an immense screen, full orchestra and chorus bring the music of Middle-earth uniquely to life.
Don't miss the RTE Concert Orchestra and Chorus perform The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, live at the O2, October 27th. Tickets from £39.50 are on sale now. For more, see rte.ie/co.
The RTE Concert Orchestra. Love your orchestras.
Hiya, Mary Bourne here. Did you know Ireland's biggest coffee morning for hospice is September 19th? So get brewing for our ladies' hospice and care services. Visit coffeemorning.ie or call us on 1850 660606 today for your free Bewley's coffee pack.
Did you know that Bosch is the winner of the Which Best Home Appliance Brand 2013, making it 3 years in a row? With technology like active water, Bosch washing machines and dishwashers never use a drop more water than needed for any load. So go ahead, put an award winner in your home today. And with the installation of water meters already started, it's even easier to save water, energy and money with every load. Bosch, invented for life. Save even more with Bosch Summer Savings now on at participating retailers. Find yours at bosch-home.ie.
This month in Home Store and More, we've three great offers. All metal bins, all stools and chairs, and all laundry baskets are half price. That's right, half price. But better hurry, because when all our half price metal bins are gone, they're gone. And when all our half price stools and chairs are gone, they're gone too. And as for all our half price laundry baskets, when they're gone, they're definitely gone, gone, gone. All these offers are now available to buy online at homestoreandmore.ie. Home Store and More. Believe us when we say, more savings every day. Visit us in store, check us out online at homestoreandmore.ie.
On RTE Radio 1 now, we join Marion Richardson.
Good morning. They came from all walks of life to say a final farewell to poet and Nobel laureate Seamus Heaney. Eminent figures from political and cultural circles were joined by hundreds of women and men who both loved the man and his poetry, who felt he was one of their own. It was a traditional and low-key funeral mass at the Sacred Heart Church in Donnybrook here in Dublin. In a tribute to his father, his son Michael revealed Seamus's last words in a text to his wife Mary, his closest companion and muse of 48 years.
The extraordinary tributes that have been paid over the last few days in print and over the airwaves, as well as by all of you who are here today, have left us in no doubt as to what an inspiration he was. His generosity and spirit, as well as his obvious gifts as a poet, left everyone who met him feeling lucky to have known him. But of course, as his family, we feel luckiest of all to have had such a wonderful husband, father and grandfather. It's been hard to stay strong and brave in the face of such a sudden and devastating loss, but we take comfort in our memories and especially in the messages and love of support that we've received from so many dear friends and family over the last few days, as well as from, of course, the people who are just moved by his poetry. And we also draw strength from Dad himself. His last few words, in a text message he wrote to my mother minutes before he passed away, were in his beloved Latin, and they read, "Noli temere." Don't be afraid. Thank you so much.
Seamus's friend, fellow poet and Pulitzer Prize winner Paul Muldoon, gave the eulogy at the funeral mass, and Paul remembered a phone call to the Heaney household all of 30 years ago.
The phone was answered by Michael, as it turns out. He was a teenager at the time, and having known him since he was a boy, I was glad to have the chance to have a chat and hear what he was up to. And after a while, there was a little pause, and Michael ventured, "I suppose you'll want to speak to Head the Bomb." So, not being a parent at the time, I was a little taken aback. by the familiarity, perhaps the over-familiarity, of this nomenclature. And even if Michael didn't call Seamus Head the ball to his face, which I'm pretty sure he didn't, I realise now it was a very telling moment about Seamus and his family. A moment that suggested a wonderfully relaxed attitude between father and teenage son.
And Paul Muldoon spoke about Seamus Heaney's big heart.
On the subject of the heart, when Seamus was fitted with a monitored electronic device a few years ago, he took an almost unseemly delight in announcing, and we were hearing about the Beatitudes earlier, blessed are the pacemakers.
And referring to an incident in which Seamus Heaney sprinted to pick up his daughter, Catherine Ann, when she fell as a toddler, he spoke about Seamus Heaney's unparalleled capacity to sweep all of us up in his arms. And he spoke of the sorrow at the loss of such a wonderful human being.
And it was Seamus Heaney's unparalleled capacity to sweep us all of us up in his arms that we're honouring today. Though Seamus helped all of us to develop our imaginative powers, we may still only imperfectly imagine what Mary is going through. She above all recognises that other great attribute of Seamus Heaney. I'm thinking of his beauty. Today we mourn with Mary and the children, as well as the extended families, the nation, the wide world. We remember the beauty of Seamus Heaney as a bard, of course, and today in particular in his being.
As the Mass came to a close, one of Seamus's own poems, The Given Note, was read by his close friend, poet and publisher Peter Fallon.
On the most westerly blasket, in a dry stone hut, he got this air out of the night. Strange noises were heard by others who followed. Bits of a tune coming in on loud weather, though nothing like melody. He blamed their fingers and ears as unpracticed, their fiddling easy, for he had gone alone into the island and brought back the whole thing. The house throbbed like his full violin. So whether he calls it spirit music or not, I don't care. He took it out of wind off mid-Atlantic. Still, he maintains from nowhere. It comes off the bow gravely, rephrases itself into the air.
Perth Nabokki, played by another friend and collaborator, Piper Liam O'Flynn, with Neil Martin. Seamus grew up in the South Derry village of Ballaghy, and we can only imagine a young Heaney's delight in a local rhyme, recalled by Niall McMonagall in the funeral commentary.
You mentioned Ballaghy there, Sean, and among the very first poems Seamus Heaney loved was a little local rhyme, too late shall be the cry, the Ballaghy bus goes sailing by.
And it was to the village of Ballaghy that Seamus Heaney chose to return in the end. He was buried there in the family plot last Monday evening. But in fact, he belonged to all of us, and his sense of Ireland came through in much of his work.
Postscript. And sometime, make the time to drive out west into County Clare along the flaggy shore in September or October when the wind and the light are working off each other so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter and inland among stones the surface of a slate-grey lake is lit by the earth-lightning of a flock of swans, their feathers ruffed and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown, headstrong-looking heads tucked or cresting or busy underwater. Useless to think you'll park and capture it more thoroughly. You are neither here nor there. A hurry through which known and strange things pass, as big soft buffetings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open.
And catch the heart off guard and blow it open, and many's the heart that was blown right open with his passing. Palea Kerlor. And tomorrow morning here on RT Radio 1, John Bowman will continue with his month-long tribute to Seamus Heaney and his work on Bowman's Sunday, 8:30. Well, after a blaze of publicity and rumours of microphones at dawn, Sean O'Rourke finally took over the helm of the Today Show last Monday.
Welcome to Liveline. Talk to Joe. We're in a new world, folks. Big Daddy has left the building. Pat Kenny gone after 41 years in RTE. Mind you, if you subtract his holidays, he only worked here for about 12 of them. Pat's on the Liveline. Pat, we'll never hear from you again. Go ahead.
Yes, I encourage my old listeners to move the dial because everyone needs directions to news chat or whatever it's called.
Sure.
All you have to do is simply switch signal to circa 106 megahertz on the FM or frequency modulation spectrum.
I've lost
you. If you need assistance, just call this number, 1890-106-108-76543, Alpha Bravo Omega, hashtag Pat Support.
I don't follow Pat Support.
Not to be confused with Pat's Port, where I sniff out the best late bottled vintage with Catherine Fulvio. Can't wait to get my hands on her.
Sean O'Rourke, the new man in the hot seat. Go ahead, Sean.
In the shadows of Gotham, I work alone. On the agenda for our first week, Dennis O'Brien gets a seat at the Global Irish Economic Forum, and will one seat be enough to accommodate his ever-expanding assets?
Go on.
Pat Kenny, will his salary be paid out of the new broadcast charge? And News Talk, can the fledgling college and hipster radio service survive an inevitable massive drop in advertising revenue? I love the smell of napalm in the morning.
Oliver Callan heard on the Today Show with Sean O'Rourke. Well, one of Sean's guests was internationally acclaimed writer Margaret Atwood. She was in Dublin to headline the Mountains to Sea Festival in Dúnlera. She's, of course, a Booker Prize winner and, you would imagine, an unlikely tweeter.
You're an indefatigable tweeter, if I could put it like that.
I don't know about indefatigable.
But you do it a lot.
I do it a lot. It's like having your own little radio station. So you can invite people on as guests, as it were, and you can have the equivalent of a phone-in segment to your radio show, and you can mention other people's books that you've read and liked and bits of news that your followers might find of interest.
But you don't use it to push your own literature.
Would you use your radio program to push your own book? No, you would not. No, you would not.
That's one that I don't have to answer because there's no book, at least not yet.
Margaret Atwood is Canadian with a big C and a committed environmentalist.
You're well known, I suppose, partly because in your childhood you were the daughter of a biologist and you spent some time, I think was it 6 months a year, living in the Canadian wilderness. You have long held a great concern for the environment. And interestingly, I'm not sure if you've seen it, you probably have, Time magazine had a cover lately and it was A World Without Bees, and that's something dear to your heart.
Yes, it certainly is. And there's been a lot of talking and thinking about what is causing the bees to decrease. Oddly enough, urban beekeepers are not having the same kinds of problems. There is, for instance, a flourishing hive or two on the top of the Canadian Opera Company in Toronto. So people are thinking quite carefully about this, but a world without bees would have very bad consequences for us.
Just coming back to this idea of plausible fiction and speculative fiction, how do you see the future of this planet? Is the future bright or bleak?
I think we have a choice. We still have a choice, and people are working very, very hard at the problems that we know we have. But number one, should we kill the ocean, that will be the end of us, because it does produce 60 to 80% of the oxygen that we breathe.
Margaret Atwood, and I had the good fortune to hear Margaret in conversation with Katrina Crowe on Tuesday at the Mountains to Sea Festival, which continues this weekend, by the way. I'll be there myself tomorrow, chairing a session with writers Jennifer Johnston and Selena Guinness on memoir and fiction, so I hope you'll join us. Canadian environmental devastation was the focus of last Saturday's documentary on One, Undue Alarm. Nicolene Greer went all the way to northern Canada, where Irish doctor John O'Connor is a GP to a tiny remote community of Indigenous Canadians. They live downstream from one of the biggest oil mining operations in the world, the Alberta oil sands. Dr. O'Connor started working in the town of Fort Chipewyan in 2000 and soon discovered that all was not as well as it seemed.
The easiest way with the deer is to go like this, see?
Just pull it at the same time?
Yeah, look.
The land is wild and abundant. The people here are traditionally hunters, trappers and fur traders. For centuries, their diet has consisted of fish from the lake, berries gathered in the bush, meat caught in the land, and water from their river.
I've been all over in this part, right into northwest territories, hunting caribous. Caribous are the animals. That's one of them laying on that picture, see? I'm holding over there the antler. They call caribous one of the best meat there is.
And until recently, it was considered a very healthy way to survive.
My expectation was that I would see a community that was overall healthy. And as I got to know them and got to know their previously documented medical histories, it increasingly dawned on me that, you know, this was not as healthy a community as what I expected. A lot of previously documented illnesses, cancers in many cases, and also a whole slew of autoimmune diseases, which didn't make a whole lot of sense to me, you know, such a small community, 1,200 people.
Dr. O'Connor went public with his concerns over the health of his patients, calling for a major health study to be done. What happened next was not what he expected, and he found himself at the centre of a national controversy.
So there was a lot of suspicion, and when that meeting ended, people were shaking their heads, just, you know, saying, this is not, there's something wrong here. I felt at that point, I'm part of this community. I'd been, I think, 6 or 7 years their only physician. We were on our own.
Dr. O'Connor had not been silenced, and he continued to speak out against the findings that there was no problem in Fort Chipewyan. But it wasn't long before he would pay the price.
And then in late 2006, early 2007, I got a series of complaints against me at the College of Physicians in Edmonton. These complaints came from Health Canada and from Alberta Health. It was a shock, a big package in the mail first. I was stunned. My wife, Charlene, was, I think we were in the kitchen at the end of the day, and just opening this bundle, and I had nothing to say. I was totally, totally speechless. And I read the stuff a few times. I don't think I absorbed it. Charlene went through every word of it and just threw it down in disgust, saying, this is crap. And, you know, and look at the people that are complaining. The physicians from Health Canada that came to the community and said, there's nothing wrong. And these are the people on whose watch all this happened.
From the documentary on One, and you'll have another chance to hear Undue Alarm, made by Nicolene Greer, tomorrow evening at 6 o'clock. Well, Una Butler's world fell apart 3 years ago. On a November day, her husband John killed their two young daughters. He strangled 6-year-old Zoe and smothered 2-year-old Ella before dousing himself in petrol and crashing his car into a tree and killing himself. John suffered from depression, and Una is now spearheading a campaign to ensure that the welfare of children is part of the Mental Health Act. This would require medical personnel to involve the families of patients with mental health issues. She was Miriam O'Callaghan's guest on Tuesday.
My sister rang me when I was nearly home, about 5 miles from home, to say, can you come down to reception? She was in my workplace because she had been, the guards had called to her and she was coming over to collect me from work, but I had left previous to that. And she rang me on the phone and she asked me, can you come down to reception? And I said, well, I'm on the way home. And I said, is everything all right? And she said, no. And I actually put the phone down. I didn't want to know I think it was like a gut instinct there was something wrong. So I continued driving until I met the guards then, about a mile from home. And my brother came down to meet me and told me what had happened. I had to pass my house because John had crashed up the road. And I remember asking the guard, you know, who's in the car? And he said, it's just one person. But I said, where's Ella? Because he was meant to be minding Ella, I presumed, so he would be in school. But I think my brother had told me, and we were passing my house, and I wanted to go down to see Zoe and Ella. And I was told I wasn't allowed. But I think at the same time, I didn't want to go down. I didn't want to believe what I was hearing.
What did your brother tell you?
He said that John had murdered Zoe and Ella.
Una Butler, heard on The John Murray Show with Miriam. On Wednesday, RT's political correspondent David McCullough was unveiled as the new presenter on Primetime. David has had a stellar career documenting the goings-on in Leinster House, and he is, of course, the author of two weighty books, The Reluctant Taoiseach, a biography of John A. Costello, and a tome on the first inter-party government. But Sean O'Rourke was preoccupied with other matters.
What about the short pants, David? When we were Googling you this morning, David McCullough shorts is the suggestion the search engine made. I mean, there's a famous tweeted picture of you during one of the hot days in July.
Yeah, I got a lot of abuse about that. I mean, basically, I was sitting at home. I'd done my day's work. I'd gone home, sitting in the garden, having me tea, and they rang me, could I come in, do something for the nine? So I said I could. I changed into my shorts out of my suit, and I wasn't going to bother putting the suit back on. It was a very hot day, so no harm. Nobody could see the shorts when I was on camera. I did my live. A couple of people passing by seemed to find it all very amusing and were taking photographs of me. But what can you do?
Well, I suppose you can wear those shorts now under the desk, winter or summer. Now, it's also well known you're a big fan of The Boss, not The Boss that used to be The Boss. How many concerts were you at for Bruce Springsteen?
This time?
Yes.
Well, he played 5 dates in Ireland, so I went to 5.
And how many in all?
30, I think. Not that I'm counting or anything.
And there was a documentary?
There was, yeah. I got to, I suppose when you talk about highlights of your career, one of them or two of them was I got to interview Bruce twice. And you might wonder how a political correspondent got to interview Bruce Springsteen. And the answer is, as a very wise colleague said, there's no point having the inside track if you don't use it. So that's what I did. I got to interview him twice, and we put a little programme together again a couple of years ago using some of the interview footage and some other bits and pieces. So yeah, it's nice when you're passionate.
I've got to warn you, David, it's starting already. Now I will never miss Primetime. I have quite a crush on David. That's Aoife Mullingar. What a great choice for Primetime. David is excellent, I must say. Easy on the eye too. Well done, David, from Catherine. That's great news. Another texter. He's very handsome and has a great face for television.
David McCullough with Sean O'Rourke on the Today programme on Wednesday. Best-selling author Emma Donoghue's book Room is being made into a film by Lenny Abrahamson.
Was it Lenny that wrote to you, Emma? How did it come about?
Well, you know, it's funny because you'd think directors would all use this technique, but he's the only one who actually wrote to me with a detailed description of his response to the novel and of how he could imagine sort of translating its magic into the screen. I mean, my advice to all directors would be to do this, because most people just vaguely gush, you know, or just say, oh, let me have the rights to your novel. But Lenny actually had a vision for it. And, you know, I've always thought it's the kind of novel you could make a really bad film of. You could so easily turn it into either really sappy, I love you, mommy kind of stuff, or else a really creepy kind of television rape movie. So I was really determined to hold out till I found somebody who had, you know, kind of impeccable taste. So he's not going to mess it up. It's a child's eyes story about a horrible crime, basically. It was suggested to me by the Fritzl case in Austria, but it's not closely based on any one case. But it's basically the story of a 5-year-old boy growing up in a locked room, which he thinks is the whole world, because his mother has convinced him, you know, using a kind lie, she's convinced him that this is the whole world, because she doesn't want him to know that he was born to her, you know, after her kidnapper impregnated her. So it's about horrible events, but I think the child's perspective ensures that it's really not a horrible story at all. In some ways, it's a very magical kind of story.
And Emma told Miriam that she also has her own little rituals when she's writing.
You live in London, Ontario. That's, I think, where you're speaking to me from now, Emma.
That's right. I'm speaking to you from my treadmill desk. I started working on a treadmill this year. But you walk along at 2.5 miles an hour and you type.
Seriously?
Because I hate exercise, you see. So I thought if I could possibly build exercise into my writing day. Like, I'm always promising the kids I'll live to be 100. And it struck me that that wasn't actually very likely if I never did a tittle of exercise.
So for how long of your writing day do you stay on the treadmill?
About 4 hours.
Seriously?
I know. And I actually... sweat. I have to change my clothes at the end of the day. This is a complete change of life for me at 43. I'm absolutely thrilled to have found some way to build in exercise.
Emma Donoghue with Miriam O'Callaghan on Thursday, Not a Moment Wasted.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson. Podcast today's programme at rte.ie/radioplayer.
Venice, 1646. Dear Julia, the gondola business is sinking. All because of a new man that's arrived. His gondola is faster and looks unlike any that I have seen before. He calls it Una Jet Ski Banana Boat. Now all the customers want to ride the canals with him. Alas, I live in hope they'll soon want to travel in the old style again.
The business that thinks forward gets ahead. Discover how Vodafone Red Business can give you the edge. Search Vodafone Think Forward. Vodafone. Power to you.
Bull Gosh Energy Theatre is proud to bring you the smash hit musical Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, starring Jason Donovan direct from the West End. Don't miss this spectacular musical from October 15th for 2 weeks only, featuring over 500 of the most outrageous costumes you have ever seen, plus 25 of your favourite disco anthems, including Girls Just Want to Have Fun, It's Raining Men, Boogie Wonderland, Finally, I Will Survive, and many more. Tickets from €20. See BoardGoshEnergyTheatre.ie and join us on a journey to the heart of fabulous.
Today from 11 on RTE Radio 1.
What are you seeing?
We get complaints from people who have been through the mortgage arrears process. First, there's people who are dissatisfied with the process. They say the banks are not listening to them. They're not taking into account their own individual circumstances. They're not engaging with them. They're not offering them the kinds of solutions that they would find acceptable. And then the second one is that they're simply unhappy with the outcome.
The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Unpost. You can pay over 100 different bills free at the post office. Unpost. Do more.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Well, it's no secret that women have been largely written out of Irish history. So it was heartening that as we begin the decade of commemorations with the 1913 lockout, the new Liffey Bridge is to be named for Rosie Hackett, a trades union activist who fought for workers' rights and who was also involved in the War of Independence. Rosie was born in a tenement in Abbey Street in 1892 and worked as a messenger in Jacob's factory. In an interview with Donoghue O'Dooling, she told of her involvement in the struggle and how she was in Liberty Hall to witness the printing of the first Proclamation of Independence. She later gave the first copy to James Connolly.
They worked all night, you see, doing the proclamation, you see. But when I went in, there was three men in the printing where the machine was, the machine room. One man walked over and shook hands with me, congratulated me. I was the first that was allowed in to the printing, like during the proclamation being done.
This is the first bridge to honour a woman, and Rosie's nephew, John Gray, spoke with Gavin Jennings on Tuesday's Morning Ireland.
After the 1913 lockout, she was one of several people who didn't get their jobs back in Jacobs. She helped to form the Irish Women's Workers Union. She worked in a little shop at the back of Liberty Hall for a lot of years actually. And actually during the time of the 1913 lockout, she actually lived in Old Abbey Street, which runs from the back of Liberty Hall almost to the new bridge. So I suppose it's very fitting that the bridge has been named after her. This is about Rosie, what she did, what she stood for, and women like her at that time and even today. And I was really, really impressed by the amount of young women who became involved in the campaign to have the bridge named after Rosie.
What do you think she would make of a bridge in Dublin being named after her?
I'd say she'd be giggling quietly to herself. She would be slightly embarrassed about it. But, you know, she'd also be very proud to know that women have come to where they are in Dublin at this stage. I would think, it's hard to say exactly what she would think, but I know she would have an opinion on the way things are in this country at the moment. And, you know, I'd say if she was still with us, she'd be back out fighting again to try and rectify this country.
And the Rosie Hackett Bridge over the River Liffey will be officially opened next year. Well, the biggest selling daily newspaper, the Irish Independent, has a new editor. She's Claire Grady from the West.
So left Westport at 17 to come to the big smoke, obviously, because that's what you did in those days. That's where I grew up. Brilliant town. Get back there as often as I can.
Did you get the start journalistically locally?
Well, I did actually. The year I left school, all I wanted to do from, I'd say, about the age of 13, 14 was be a newspaper reporter. I don't know why. There was no newspaper reporters in the family. There was no connection with journalism whatsoever. But I just got into my head that I wanted to be a reporter. And the year I left school, I got a placement in the Mayo News for 4 or 5 months. And that was fantastic. I mean, when I think now, I mean, it was in the last century, obviously, hot metal. There were still journalists who actually, their stories were handwritten and typewriters were all the thing then, but it just confirmed that's what I wanted to do.
What did you bring to the interview board when you were going for this job? What did you tell them you wanted to do with the paper?
I told them I had faith in the paper, that I believed it was going to last for another while. I do believe, I mean, obviously you'd be blind not to notice what's going on in the newspaper industry. I don't think there will be the same number of newspapers around in the next 4 or 5 years as there has been. I mean, the Irish public have been absolutely voracious newspaper readers. I mean, I grew up in a home where we had 2 newspapers every day, several on a Sunday, all the local papers. Sadly, some newspapers are going to fold.
As you sit down with your blank sheet of paper or whatever you operate with to edit the paper for tomorrow,
yes.
Who do you have in mind?
The big thing is I probably have about 5 different people in mind. A woman in her 30s maybe, collecting the kids from school, leaving the kids to school and picking up the paper on the way home. So we focus a lot on consumer-driven stories, parental-type stories, people who are interested in politics, people who are passionate about sport. I mean, nobody reads the Irish Independent to get the results of the match. What they read it is to see what Martin Brenny thought of the match.
And so I'm keeping,
exactly. Or Tony Ward in the rugby season. That's what they're reading it for.
Claire Grady, editor of the Irish Independent, with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday. Well, the news from Syria is really depressing and sad, with Western leaders failing to reach any kind of agreement on intervention.
Unfortunately, for the past 2.5 years, the system devised in 1945 precisely to deal with threats of this nature did not work as it was supposed to. It has not protected peace and security for the hundreds of Syrian children who were gassed to death on August 21. It is not protecting the stability of the region. It is not standing behind now an internationally accepted ban on the use of chemical weapons. Instead, the system has protected the prerogatives of Russia, the patron of a regime that would brazenly stage the world's largest chemical weapons attack in a quarter century, while chemical weapons inspectors sent by the United Nations were just across town. And even in the wake of the flagrant shattering of the international norm against chemical weapons use, Russia continues to hold the Council hostage and shirk its international responsibilities, including as a party to the Chemical Weapons Convention. What we have learned, what the Syrian people have learned, is that the Security Council the world needs to deal with this crisis is not the Security Council we have.
The US Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power there. Well, on the ground, the rising numbers of refugees and the expected drop in temperatures will make the work of aid agencies even more difficult. There are 2 million refugees and over 4 million people displaced within Syria itself. David Adams works with the international humanitarian agency GOAL, operating on the Syria-Turkey border, and he spoke with Mary Wilson on Drive Time.
Well, I was in Syria before whenever news came through from Damascus of the chemical attack and the West's reaction to that. And I mean, people were angry, as they have been for years, at yet another atrocity committed by the regime or by whoever. It doesn't really matter. But they're angry as well that people, they can't understand the distinction being drawn between so-called conventional weapons and chemical weapons. As far as they're concerned, if they're burying their children, their parents, their siblings, you know, it doesn't really matter how they were killed. And what they're saying and what they've said to me is, listen, you know, does this send the signal to Assad then? You can kill as many of us as you want by whatever means you want, as long as you don't use chemical weapons. And I'm afraid, you know, that's a view that I would tend to hold as well. It doesn't really make much difference to people. So many atrocities have been committed against them. And as far as they're concerned, the West has stood by and watched and done nothing about it. And now that the chemical weapons have been used, people are getting excited about it. They want the violence ended. However it's brought to an end, they want it ended so that an international aid effort of massive proportions can be initiated to help these people. I mean, it's barely imaginable, it's barely describable to anyone who hasn't been there what it's like in Syria and what it's like for the Syrian people.
From Drive Time with Mary Wilson on Tuesday. Well, all this week the banks have been in the dock before the Oireachtas Finance Committee. They're being questioned about how they're dealing with the mortgage debt mountain. On Tuesday's Morning Ireland, we heard Anne and Joe, who got into difficulty with their mortgage 3 years ago when Anne became ill and Joe lost his job.
To be honest with you, I hate this country. If I was younger, if I was 20 years younger, I'd be gone. I really would. Dealing with the bank, been spoken to like you're something that they'd scrape off your shoe, which is how they spoke to me, was very degrading. It just changes you, and it just makes you just, not angry per se, but just, you know, you just think, why am I bothering, you know?
You're totally trapped. You don't have a life. And you don't, all you're doing is existing every single day. And certainly if the kids had been younger, they were both in secondary school. If the kids had been anything up to maybe 5 or 6, I think we would have upped and gone and we would have never come back.
But as always, the devil is in the detail. The banks were set targets by the central bank to deal with the debt crisis, and Mary Wilson spoke with DCU economist Tony Foley.
Was there any sign of humility here or of lessons learned by the men who lined up before the Oireachtas Committee?
I'd have to say no. In terms of ranking of them, I suppose I'd put PTSB first in terms of the data and engagement with the committee, AIB last, and the other two broadly together in the middle. I particularly thought it started off badly with AIB. I think not really fully engaging with the committee and not, as it were, presenting the data that might have been expected. But whether people learned from that as the week went on, the information available and the engagement got better as things went on.
What did we learn?
I wouldn't sort of see any tremendous improvement in bank attitudes. Maybe it's a natural condition of being a banker that you're confident and tough and arrogant because you're dealing with billions of money, as it were.
The issue was also discussed on Sean O'Rourke's gathering yesterday with guests Terry Prone, Noel Whelan, Jill Kirby and Dan O'Brien. And Terry was bamboozled by a deputy from Dublin South.
Did you get much chance to look at the bankers going before the TDs and senators at the Oireachtas Finance Committee?
I got online at the bit where Peter Matthews had cut across Richie Boucher. And he was like somebody who had got the ball and was planning to take it into the next county. Because you know the way Peter Matthews talks. Peter Matthews would not recognise a full stop if it got up and bit him squarely in the watsits. And secondly, he has a form of political paraphrenia where if you say banks to him, he just gives you an instant tutorial and it goes on for several years. So Peter Matthews was in full flow. And then you began to hear voices off. And the voices off were saying things like, this is not the way it should be. Somebody's breaking the rules. And then it became clear that one of the voices off was the chairman. And the chairman was getting very aggro over something or other, probably related to Peter Matthews. And eventually he sort of threw himself under Matthews's wheels and Peter Matthews ground to a halt, which was probably the achievement of the entire week for the chairman.
Noel Whelan, are we any wiser after these hearings?
Well, in fairness, this is kind of the most effective use of Oireachtas committees, is starting to do something they've done in America a long time, which is bring the people in and ask them the bloody tough questions. Paraphrenia, I think, Terry.
Paraphrenia.
Paraphrenia. It sounds like a disease. Listen,
it is.
This is a malaise, and all the Oireachtas committee could do is the most superficial of examinations. My instinct is that apart from the growing numbers of long-term unemployed and the fact that they're becoming long-term unemployed, this is the most potentially dangerous economic, social and political issue in the country. My instinct is that behind middle-class doors in this country, and not just middle-class doors, there is real terror about the financial circumstances. He's lying to her or she's lying to him about the extent of the problem they've been. They've thought they could kick the can down the road until growth came and growth ain't coming, and growth ain't coming for a 3 or 4 years. The banks, if you talk to people in these circumstances, are swamped. They are swamped. They can't handle the volume. The easiest thing to do is to print press a button that sends out 8,000 letters threatening legal action, what they're not in a position to do is deal one-on-one with the level of financial data people require. Even where it's as straightforward as one house, one mortgage, it's complex. But in circumstances where each of the banks are dealing with people with other mortgages as well, which have to be resolved in the same context, or unsecured debt, by the time the banks are in a position to get their heads stuck into the one-on-one relationships, the financial information is out of date and it's just a mess.
Barrister Noel Whelan and Terry Prone heard on Today with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. While over on Liveline, Philip Boucher-Hayes' callers were discussing bankruptcy tourism.
But do you not think the easy option would be, Deirdre, for me to say, OK, I'm talking to the banks on a daily basis, I'm not getting anywhere. Do you not think the easy option would be, you know what, I'm going to leave my job, I'm going to go home, and I'm going to put my feet up every day, and you know what, feck everything and feck everybody. Do you not think that's the easy option? Why do you think me going to London is an easy option?
Because you can come back in 12 months' time, James, and all your debts are written off. You don't have to pay anything. You can make a fresh start. You don't have to pay anything.
And why would you begrudge me of that?
Because I think that the people in this country are picking up enough rubbish for people.
Okay, and what do you put any responsibility whatsoever on the banks?
A certain amount, yes. But it's not all the banks' fault.
It's not?
It's not what? All the banks' fault. People were more than willing to take the money in the first place.
Can I ask you a question? For example, okay, let's say I was your daughter, okay? If I'm your daughter and I come back and I'm at home in Ireland and I bought a house in 2007 and it's now worth less than half what I paid for it. I've also got a car loan and a credit union loan that I can no longer pay back. At the time, I was earning good money and I could afford to do it. At the moment, I can't do it. And I came to you and I said, listen, I'm struggling here and I've been struggling. What would your advice be to me?
I tell you to man up and pay your debts, James. I'm sorry.
Well, what, Deirdre? Well, what?
I go get work, James. Get work. You can do it from London.
You're working
in London. Yes. Well, why aren't you paying off your debts here then? If you're working in London, we all have to do it. I was in London in 1989, and there was repossessions going on at the rate of 100 a week, I'd say.
James and Deirdre are slugging it out on Liveline.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson. Podcast today's programme at rte.ie/radioplayer.
Did you know that over the last 10 years, RTE has diverted over 3,694 tonnes of waste from landfill? A new report in association with the EPA reviews RTE's environmental performance. If you'd like to read the report, go to rte.ie/about. Meanwhile, tune in to The Mooney Show on RTE Radio 1 for more information on the associated Fuel Your School competition. RTE. Today, tomorrow, together.
We're almost under starters' orders for the world's famous Listowel Race Week from Sunday the 15th to Saturday the 21st of September. That's 7 days of exhilarating on- and off-course entertainment to really get your heart racing. Wednesday is Kerry National Day and Ladies' Day is on Friday. Plus, there's a massive jackpot to be won each and every day. Remember, Sunday the 15th to Saturday the 21st of September. Listowel. Serious fun, serious racing.
Oh yeah, our restaurants are lively places, especially when they're full of people.
Admiring the boot on the latest model? Car showroom lighting is key. After all, it is a big decision.
Buying a burger. We run a high energy business. That's why we switched to Energia for their combination of
competitively priced energy and great customer service.
From Supermax to Windsor Motors, Energia is the choice of over 65,000 Irish businesses. Visit energia.ie. Energia. Energy that means business.
Playback on RTE Radio 1 with Marion Richardson.
Well, hygiene, or lack of it, was also preoccupying Liveline listeners in the wake of the HICWA report that doctors didn't wash their hands in Beaumont Hospital.
I was just post-brain surgery and I needed to go to the bathroom and I had to get myself out of the bed to use a communal bathroom because it was a high dependency with men and women in it. And men, like the people there were like half a head. It was like really traumatic war to be in. But when I opened the toilet door, there was excrement all over the floor, like right in the centre of it. And nurses had been in and out in all of the units. I wouldn't enter the room because I thought my head's completely open from ear to ear. I don't pick up any type of infection. I had to ask for it twice to be cleaned. A nurse came in. She got a piece of paper from where you get it to sort of dry your hands. She swiped it up, threw it down the toilet, flushed the toilet and walked out. No disinfectant on the floor. She didn't wash her hands, nothing. I went walking with my head open from ear to ear down the corridor on my own about 12 hours post-op to try and find a toilet that was actually clean. And what I could say is that in the high dependency unit, there was tons of blood and all over.